I think many of you'll know who we are. This is Peter, this is me, Chris Whitfield. We felt that SIDS department in the 90s, late 60s, 70s was a wild, exciting place, and it, most important perhaps, it was the birthplace of EMAS. Well, a bit later, in the mid 70s, Peter mainly and I put a thing together down the road in that college, you know, the Gold Murray House, which demonstrated again, in addition to what EMAS had done, and demonstrated just how much could be got out of a relatively low-powered machine if the compiler technology was some good. And you could do it with a small team. You didn't need thousands of people, it could be done. So anyway, over to Peter, because he can describe the compiler technology.
Okay, thank you. 1980, that was, some changes. That's the machine we're going to be talking about, or the general type, and Interdata there. This is going to be fairly light-hearted, I hope. So what we did with compilers about 32 years ago. 32 years ago, just to put it in context, that was the sort of thing they used to put on the front of computer manuals, sex cells. Now, no doubt we're going to expose a lot of our prejudices and act like old farts in complaining about the way things are now, but that's the fun of these things. We're going to make references to a homegrown operating system, which was called Mouses for Murray House System, obviously. Now that, I'm joking, but it was a serious system. It serviced 8 terminals, a batch stream, and dial-up users for schools who were making use of the system. Now, this was on a 256 kilobyte machine. Segmented, no paging, slow disks, quarter of a megabyte to get that in. I should say, I suppose, that all the work we did and all the work we're going to be talking about wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Peter Barker, then head of maths and computing, who was incredibly supportive. Now, this wasn't directly in the context of what was happening in the department and the ERCC at the time, but I think it shows some of the ideas diffusing out. I say diffusing deliberately because I think people would agree there was a huge amount of impressive work going on in Edinburgh, and very few people knew about it. It's interesting to speculate what might have happened if people had said a bit more, blown their own trumpets. Maybe we would have got away from the idea nowadays, which seems that the only criterion for a successful program execution is it didn't crash. Anyway, this was in the summer of 1975. I was working on compilers in the department and had just come back from teaching a course in Denmark. And Chris was working at Murray House.
Quick. Murray House at that point trained teachers. It's now part of the university, but it also provided computing facilities for local schools and also did batch work for primarily the Scottish Education Department processing exam marks. All this was done in Fortran, so the depressing need for pragmatism is quite simple. We were replacing a machine, and it had to run Fortran, and that was the end of that. The recommendation of the 732 was quite simple. It looked like an IBM 360 in addressing terms. And in fact, the thing that torpedoed the VAX was that it was little endian, because it was very difficult to port 360 Fortran onto a VAX, which didn't please digital one little bit, but that was how we came to have a 732. The machine came with the manufacturer's operating system, a thing called OS32, which was actually quite a good real-time host, but it certainly wasn't a time-sharing system. And after EMAS, Hamish's IMP system on the 915, and even MTS at Newcastle, this all seemed a bit archaic, dinosaur-like, whatever. So we looked for a way around it. I produced a toy subsystem that ran on top of the thing and allowed editing and launching batch jobs and the like. But it still didn't really give us an interactive system. I phoned up Sid because at that point I was running a B.Ed. course in conjunction with the computer science department, and asked Sid if he knew how to get out of this. Did he have an IMP compiler? So he pointed at the good Mr. Robertson, who'd been doing this work, as he said, and he agreed to port his IMP onto the 732. So that's where that started. Which part?
Yeah. After seeing Chris, I agreed to do a port, not knowing what I was letting myself in for. The first port, it took us about 4 or 5 weeks to get a compiler. Now, this was from the 16-bit Interdata compiler we'd been using in the department that I'd written, and I stretched it. It got up on Chris's subsystem, so you could now compile programs from there. Doing that, even in that short time, had thrown up a number of problems with OS 32. Some trivial, like its linker was ludicrously slow and its terminals didn't really understand what type ahead meant. But there were some significant problems, the worst being that even on the typical disks of the time, that's a 5 megabyte disk, 5 whole megabytes, if the system crashed, then it would take up to an hour to reconstruct a file system on one of these tiny disks. And this just, the system crashed a lot. So this wasn't very good. So one evening, inevitably, in the pub, we decided that, well, we've got a compiler. Hey, let's write an operating system. Maybe that's a subject for a talk later, but the key to it was the fact that there was a compiler. Now, following on from the EMAS experience, it was obvious you write operating systems in IMP with minimal assembly language. Now, that was crucial. Well, it had to be, because at the time my compilers were severely limited in what you could do for assembly language. You could dump constants in line. That was it. In hindsight, that was a very powerful impetus to us, because whenever we saw code that the compiler was producing that wasn't very good, we fixed the compiler and improved the code. To the extent that by the time we'd finished the final system, the supervisor had 78 of those constants dumping machine instructions, which wasn't bad. Now, in parallel with developing the operating system, we did a lot of work on the compiler. The biggest problem, of course, was coming from a 16-bit heritage. Its dictionary space was very limited. So we had to rewrite that. And by the time we got a compiler that was a true 32-bit compiler, everything speeded up. Right. For those of you that don't know, my compilers operated in 3 passes. 1, 2, 3. The first pass took in the source program and converted it into an intermediate code. Now, I have to acknowledge that the parser used was based on Hamish's parser from the PDP-9 system, grossly and unpleasantly overstretched, I must add, but it worked, and it worked very well. So the second pass would take this intermediate code and produce from it sequences of instructions, straight-line segments, plus a whole load of instructions for joining these together, things like branches, function definitions, calls, returns, all of these sorts of things. The principle of optimization that the second pass used was do the best you can, the best possible you can, knowing what you know now. That seemed to be very different from what a lot of compilers at the time did. They would table generate rubbish and then try to peephole optimize it into something that was sensible. We didn't like that approach. Now, even though I was developing an optimizing compiler, I found it amusing that there was one place where I had to put in a pessimization. The obvious thing, when you're generating code, that just loads a constant into a register and stores it. So now if you see the constant again, you use the register instead because that's faster, usually. There was an anomaly on the 732 to do with the shift instruction. It had two. It had a short 16-bit instruction that could shift 15 bits either way, and it had a 32-bit instruction that took the contents of a register plus a constant and would use that as the shift. Using the standard optimization, that's what it would generate, and it would generate this SLL, shift left logical, which is a 32-bit slow instruction. So I had to pessimize it by looking at the register, seeing if it actually contained a small constant, which it did, and then replacing it with the short instruction. It's nice when machines are consistent, I suppose. If I had a register form of that, that would have been very nice. Now, the third pass of the compiler took this set of straight line fragments of code and instructions for gluing them together and did just that. One of the things that it had to do was adjust the sizes of branches. A well-known problem. The 732 had four sorts of branches: small 16-bit one, medium-sized 32-bit ones, and huge 48-bit ones. Now, the existing Perkin-Elmer software had an approach to solving this problem. Its assembler always generated the huge instruction, and then it tried to squeeze the program down. And there are two problems with that. The first was most branches are short, so the assembler spent all its time moving this branch down a little bit and then shuffling all the code up, and then moving it down a bit more and shuffling the code up. So it was very slow. But worse, they had a heuristic to do this. It wasn't an algorithm. And in surprisingly common pathological cases, it would get into an infinite loop. It'd decide to shrink it and then decide to stretch it and then shrink it. Now, here's a problem that we come into many times. They solved it. And they solved it not by thinking about it and generating a good algorithm. No, they fixed the symptoms. They gave you an option in the assembler to limit how many times it tried. We took the opposite approach. The imp compiler assumed all branches were short, which most of them were, and then stretched the code. Now that is self-limiting. It always only goes in one direction, it always only stretches, so in the worst case it'll stop when everything's 48 bits, so we knew it would stop. The second pass took full advantage of knowing there was a third pass that could do all these clever things. So it could leave many decisions to the third pass. I've always liked the idea of late binding. I think it's a wonderful way of giving you flexibility and allowing you to do things which seem quite difficult but can turn out to be very easy. An example of this comes from a compiler I wrote later, a PDP-11 imp compiler, where one day I was looking through a dump of the assembly language of the compiler compiling itself. I was always on the lookout for optimizations. And I found a mistake. I found something where it had just produced obviously wrong code. This was the routine. It was part of the compiler that was called to say, move this object R into this object L. Now, R could either be simple, a constant or a variable, or an expression, A plus B, or even more complicated. And that's what that upper field determined. So, quite a simple little function. And the output that the second pass made was something like this. Pretty obvious. It would define move. It would dump two instructions for the test. It realized that all the registers were set up. Register 1 and register 0 were the parameters. They were already in place, so you didn't need to load them. So you just need to call simple branches and another call. So the only actual code the second pass generated was that test. Then it passed it over to the third pass. The first thing that did was to notice that there is a branch to a return. So it replaced that with a return and got rid of the label. Then it noticed that it's got a call followed by a return, in fact, two of them. It also sees that the frame size is 0. There is no stack frame. So nothing was needed to be done to get into the function, and getting out was simply a jump. So call return can always be replaced, in that case, by just a simple branch to the function. Then it had another look at it and saw there's a conditional branch around an unconditional branch. Well, you can replace that with an inverted branch to the first place and get rid of the label. So there we are. Now, that's what the third pass had after going over and over the information it had. An iterative process applying extremely simple transformations. So that's what it had. It did one more thing. It decided where to place functions in memory. And it thought, might be a good idea to place this one right on top of the function complex. This means you've now got a branch to the next instruction, so it can get rid of that. So that was the code it generated. Now, the thing that confused me was the listing of assembly language was in order of source. Complex was miles away in the listing. So it looked like this code fell through into the next function, unless you looked very closely at the addresses. So that's an example of the sort of thing that you can do just by having a nice clean structure and doing simple things over and over. Bear in mind, this was all being done on a machine where no program could be anywhere close to a quarter of a megabyte. It wasn't a virtual system. You probably had about 180K for real programs. So back to the system that we were using this to generate. That was the banner on our listings with a little mouse, courtesy of Ian Young there. The problems of booting the system and getting it self-supporting, again, I won't cover here, but they all came from an understanding of the bare metal and an ability to write compact code. My experience, sadly lacking skills these days. But the real insight was, again, a sadly long-forgotten technique, which you would get if you were in the department at the time. Personally, I picked it up mainly from Sid, Hamish, and David Rees. And this is the very strange technique of sitting down and thinking about the problem. It was a standing joke at the time that if you gave a student a programming problem, he'd sit down a terminal and immediately write that. And sometimes he might even start thinking after getting that down. Anyway, we got the system going, and the compiler, the new compiler, automatically supported things like, dynamic linking, automatic sharing of code. It's depressing that even today, things that were commonplace and obvious to us then are almost non-existent. I remember when the VAX turned up and looking in horror at the hoops you had to jump through to get it to share anything. And dynamic function calls, dynamic loading, closest we've got to it are DLLs, and don't like them. We also learned something else doing this, by the way, and I think this is something similar to the EMAP project, or what I saw of it, which is if you have a complex software project and you want it to work and you want it to be done relatively quickly, have the smallest possible team. So there was the compiler. It was working. We had a system that would do certain things, but we couldn't deploy it, and Chris will say why.
Right, so we had a nice system and we couldn't deploy it. It was wonderful when it was running. The schools were delighted they could dial up. It caused all sorts of trouble with Jordan Hill because we could provide schools with a service here they couldn't provide in Glasgow, and it was all fun. The problem was that there were huge numbers of Fortran batch jobs that were run, lots and lots and lots of Diddy batch jobs, which they had a regiment of punch girls punched on cards, and they'd spend half the day feeding these things through the card reader, and it would clank, 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 and every so often it would jam, so they had to clear it out. So, of course, this could easily take well into the afternoon. we couldn't get the nice system up until all this stuff had been run every day. So what do we do about it? Well, temptation is to say, well, why don't we write a Fortran compiler? This would be real fun, but the trouble is, it wouldn't be compatible, the dialect would be different, there'd be all sorts of. So actually, the practical solution is to emulate OS32's SVC interface and run the manufacturer's Fortran compiler, which is exactly what we did. The mouses, use this sequence to call the super for supervisor entries, load the floating point registers, just bang the whole lot of them, do the supervisor call, and when you come back, store them all. This was basically a rip-off from EMAS, obvious way to do it. One set of floating point registers, which is shared between everything, between both supervisor state and the. It was useful having control of the compiler because all we did was make the compiler generate the sequence, so you could write SVC whatever, and it's the compiler generates that for you, so you know, less machine code, explicit machine code. This emulator basically loaded. Interdata had this notion of a task. It was all in real-time terminology. It loaded a task image, which was the compiler, jumped to it, executed it, took the relocatables it generated, loaded their linker, their task builder task, I think it was task establishment task it was called, ran that, produced another task, which was the user program, then shoveled that in and ran that. It just did this round and round and round and round. It actually went much faster than the Fortran running on the native machine, on the native system, which perhaps matches the similar experience on the EMAS 2900 with VMEK, which did this sort of trick. And in, again, the efficiency of the underlying system was such that despite all the thrashing and emulation, the thing still went faster than the system it was emulating. So we were very happy with that. So there was one huge program left that we couldn't, it just wouldn't fit in along with the emulator. But that was fine. You know, once a month they ran this program and the rest of the time mouses was up and we had a terminal service and the schools could get in, so everybody was happy. Our problems. The problems we had, the N-squared thing, something they write about is in second year computer science books, and everybody says, oh yes, this is a big problem. In reality, we did actually hit this. The third pass had an enormous table with an enormous program. It had an enormous table. It went round and round and round and round and round. And the compiler itself on the 732 took something like 32 seconds to stretch the jumps. the quick way around this was really to exploit the language structure and make the thing process a procedure at a time, a function at a time, and then finally, only finally, do a pass over what it had now got. It had got a lot of expanded procedures. And then do a final pass over the whole thing and connect up the knitting so that the whole program as a whole could address itself. But this reduced the stretching time to about 3 seconds on the for the same program on the same machine. So yes, it's a problem, but you can get spectacular improvements. We were absolutely staggered at the effect. It was interesting, some little while later, actually, to see a paper in a journal after we'd done this the third pass. The said paper described the previous version of the third pass, something like 4 years after we'd done this work, and this was represented as belonging to I know not who. But anyway, I'm just bitching. I'm being an old a grumpy old programmer. optimization agnostics checks. There seems to be a fascination with optimization. The trouble is, it's no use optimizing it if it doesn't run correctly. So folks say, right, turn on the diagnostics, but this fills the whole thing up with diagnostic tables as well. There's a very useful distinction between diagnostics and the checking code that makes the diagnostics happen when something goes wrong. So we set out to rewrite the second pass as well, to produce one that could generate checks only, to ensure that the code executed according to the rules of the source language, not according to the rules of the machine code that it happened to have generated, with all sorts of kinks and discontinuities depending on just what little quirks there were in the machine. We generated checks for all the obvious ones, things like variable capacity exceeded, array bound violations, all this sort of stuff. The perhaps more interesting example, though, is the sort of thing that can happen when you say, fine, we've done white box testing, this thing's all okay, we've got executed every path in the program, we know it's right, it can't possibly fail. Click. What's the result of this? This has nothing to do with the program, the logic in the program. This is to do with some data value that ends up in Y. And two different machines will give a different result depending on whether it's got a barrel shifter or it does it in the microcode. The 732 produced one result on that, the 832 produced a different result. If you don't check that, you can do white box testing till you're blue in the face. The thing can still fail. It's completely data dependent. Another one, it's not just Perkin-Elmer. Another one, for example, would be the transputer, which you can put to sleep in a non-interruptible loop by telling it to shift by minus one. So it's important to check this sort of stuff. The benefits of the way we could check things, we've already said that the optimization was heavily dependent on the language structure. You exploit the features you've got in front of you. The I code, the intermediate code, dished up an awful lot of all the source language information staring you in the face. Well, why throw it all away and then sweat away at triples or something like this, trying to get the information back again, doing flow analysis? We were absolutely surprised at just what good code could be generated in an opportunistic way by looking at, we've got this, exploit it. So we started ending up talking about opportunistic optimization. I mean, this became the way it was done.
Chris, we're running over. Can we?
Right.
Can I just say something to wrap up?
Yeah, okay, good.
Just to finish off, give you a very brief, quick example of the effects of Chris's checking compiler. It produced about 35% more code than the optimizer, but only ran about 10% slower. So it was used for all sorts of programs. And one interesting one was this Fortran program that was used to normalize marks from higher exams. It was a bit slow, so somebody decided, more or less as an exercise, to rewrite it in IMP. This they did, and then ran it on some pre-existing data, and it instantly failed with an unassigned variable. So we thought, oh, the translation's wrong, so we checked the translation. And indeed, the Fortran program had an unassigned variable in it, and had done for several years. Dread to think the effect that would have had on certain people. Anyway, I think that's about it. We could go on forever, but thank you.